Accessing library computer data.
The world doesn't always adhere to logic. And sometimes when you're lost, you're found.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Continuing our run through Star Trek Discovery. Right now we're up to the episode called The Sounds of Thunder. It's the sixth episode of the second season, aired on February 21st, 2019, written by Bo-Yeon Kim and Erica Lippold, directed by Douglas Arniokoski. And in this episode, when a new signal appears over Saru's home planet, Burnham, Saru and the crew embark on a perilous mission that puts Saru in danger and raises questions about the Red Angel's intentions. Q struggles to come to terms with his new reality as a mushroom person. We're joined by Clay, as always. Clay, how are you?
Good. Would you say in this episode, or maybe his entire character arc, Saru was just a young gun with a quick fuse, who was uptight, wanted to let loose, who was dreaming of bigger things and wanted to leave his own life behind? He wasn't a yes sir, not a follower. He didn't fit the box, fit the mold, have a seat in the foyer, take a number. Would you say that he was lightning before the thunder?
Matt Ross is going to be very happy with you, I think, for having said that. But I would agree that he was the lightning before the thunder, although there's not a lot of foyers in this one, unless you count that weird Ba'ul place as being a foyer, but it looked more like that was a kind of a bedroom, in my opinion, anyway. But we're here to talk about this.
Is there, I don't know where I could work it in, but I'm sure there's a Ba'ul movement joke in here somewhere.
It's a tough name. There's a lot of irritable bowel syndrome, as was in our Discord this morning.
that's kind of you could call that. That's what they had, more or less. especially looking at those guys. Woof.
We're going to be talking about The Sounds of Thunder, which is the sixth episode, as I said, of Discovery. Focuses heavily on Saru. We go back to the little short track of Brightest Star, where they kind of reinforce all of that information. And then we move forward with the sort of evolution of the Kelpians and the what is going on with Ba'ul. We're going to get into it. We're going to take a break. I'm going to play an audio clip. And then me and Clay are going to come back and we're going to break down The Sounds of Thunder.
This is Captain Christopher Pike of the USS Discovery.
You have taken a promise to us.
What have we taken exactly?
The Kelpian Starfleet promised that it would not meddle in the internal surge of our planet.
We're investigating the signal that appeared over your planet, which I'm sure you noticed. These signals are typically followed by the arrival of an entity we call the Red Angel. Are you familiar with it?
Okay, so, Clay, in my opinion, this is a decent episode of a not very good show. What say you?
I would agree.
Yeah.
What you at home can't see is that we are actually both spinning in circles while we're talking about this. Holy crap.
Ugh. It was the most noticeably directed episode to me so far. People have always said that it's an over-directed show, and I would agree with them. But this was one where the opening scene of the threesome of Ash, Burnham, and Pike talking to each other, where the camera refuses to sit still for a second, it actually made my stomach upset a little bit. Like, I did feel dizzy watching that. Which is not something that I think you want people to do, especially if the scene is simply people talking about information that they need to convey to each other. You don't really need to go overboard with it.
That's probably why they did it, right? Because that scene is not terribly interesting.
Right.
So they had to really manipulate things and make sure the camera work was interesting, because what was being said wasn't particularly interesting.
But the camera work is just spinning one direction for over a minute.
Right.
It's just over a minute of circling in a clockwise direction, and there's no change. There's nothing else going on. It's really just that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just like manufacturing tension. It's another instance of them just kind of forcing emotional reactions onto stuff that doesn't really deserve it.
Yeah,
This was a weird one for me, because I liked the first half of it. I feel like this had a very similar problem to the last episode, where I was kind of on board for, I would say, half of it. And then there's a very sharp pivot point where someone just grabs the wheel of the car and it just drives into a tree.
Yeah, you seemed more negative online about it after it had aired than maybe you sound like now. But it certainly sounds like you did not like the ending to it.
Yeah,
I was more consistent. I kind of watched this one going, this is the show. This is what it is. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I thought that the concept and the story of this episode was strong enough to hold my attention for the entire yes. time. Like the wondering what the Ba'ul were in their relation to the Kelpians was an interesting enough mystery that I was like, oh, I'm kind of invested in this. The Ba'ul themselves are kind of cool enough where I was interested when they were on.
That thing, that guy was great. Yeah, I thought that was a really cool looking alien.
They have a good voice too when it's just the voice over the comm system with each other. It's pretty good too. But that was really it. And the show outside of that, I think it has all the same problems that Discovery really has. I'm curious what you thought was the big problem at the end of it, because to me it felt so much like all of the issues that Discovery has to this point. And we're getting a lot of comments now of people just saying, like, why don't you just say the show has bad writing and call it a day? It wouldn't be a very good podcast if that's all we did. But honestly, that is like the basis of a lot of my problems with it. And I'll get more specific, but what did you particularly not like about the ending?
Specifically, well, aside from the part where Saru all of a sudden becomes a karate master and punches a bunch of phantasm balls away.
With spikes they shoot spikes out of their heads, yeah.
Yeah, I actually didn't like at first, but then I thought about it and I liked the spike shoot. I liked the spiky thing because I was like, oh, that's kind of nice. It takes something that was a indicator of their subjugation and turns it into something that is an indicator of their empowerment, sort of.
Yeah,
it's a flight response turned into a fight response, which is fun.
Hmm.
What I didn't like was when they decided that the solution to this problem was to forcibly put the entire world through a physical evolution that turned them into the species that had eradicated the Ba'ul, and they just kind of were like, this will work itself out.
Mm-hmm.
Like that,
a lot of loosey goosey Prime Directive stuff going on here. Yeah,
I'll get to that in a second, but I laughed out loud at the point where I wrote it down. Hold on a second. So after they do the whole evolution thing, right, and Burnham at least is like, this is going to fix all the problems, they can work everything out, and then the Ba'ul power up their super weapon with the intention of destroying the entire Kelpian race, and she's like, they're choosing genocide over letting them evolve?
Yep.
It's like, yeah, you just gave their greatest enemy their entire power back. Right. What'd you think they were going to do? Of course they're going to do that.
Yeah, yep.
There's no middle ground here at the moment. Not only that, the show ends with them destabilizing the entire fucking planet and then just leaving. Yeah. Like, we don't know how the Ba'ul reacts to this. The fucking Red Angel shows up and, like, blows up all of their guns. So, are they helpless now? And what's her name there? Saru's sister is a priest in this religion, and Saru basically shows back up. I thought this was going to be, I was really looking forward to this story because I thought this was going to be more of like a truth to power sort of thing from Saru, where he was going to be, first of all, I thought there was going to be more than two fucking Kelpians in this episode.
Yes, they only show up at the end, which is crazy to me, that you never spend any time in this episode getting to know what the Kelpian life is like. It's all told to you that it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
And outside of the obvious, slavery is a bad thing. There's not much else going on.
Yeah. And so I thought it was going to be him coming back and being like, kind of speaking truth to this. The whole theme of this season has been faith versus the science, right? So what better way to have a faith versus science argument than have, it's kind of similar to the one with the church on the other planet, but it's more personal.
Yep.
Where Saru has this new information, he has this new experience that he can bring back to his people and be like, listen, I know what you guys think you believe, but I can tell you, I guarantee you are wrong. And I thought that was going to be an interesting conversation to have, and that he was going to have to work to get these people on his side. Not that they were just going to hit a magic button and turn everybody into an evolved species.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But at the end, you've got his sister, who's a priestess in this religion, who has now been like shown this new way, but in no way has made any sort of strides to be like, you know what, maybe we don't need this religious thing anymore. Like, I'm imagining she's going back to the people as this like godlike figure now. She's like, I've been to the top of the mountain. They gave me the commandments, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, we don't know how the Ba'ul react to this stuff because we don't see what happens after the Red Angel blows their shit up. There's no like meeting of the mind sequence. Like what's there's in TNG, every single fucking time they do this, there's a scene at the end, whether or not it's ham fisted or not, where they have both of the parties in the same room and they're like, you know what, maybe we should learn how to work this out.
Right. Picard is standing in the middle of it.
They don't just do it and leave. It's like they toppled the entire infrastructure of this planet and just fucking leave.
Yeah. That's true. It's
very irresponsible. It's at the least, and it's not even Saru doesn't even give a shit about it.
No.
He's happy his people have like if they come back in two episodes, right, or whatever, and they're like, let's check in on the Kelpian homeworld, and it's a fucking massacre, and then he's like, oh yeah, maybe we should have maybe thought this through a little more. Then fine, great, awesome, I'm fine with that. But this is the perfect example of why what I talk about when. Actions without consequences make for bad stories for me.
Mm.
Because this is a massive action that has zero consequence, right? It's just wrapping up this story, this tiny slice of life, essentially, story that they're trying to tell. And they are not keeping in mind the scope of the story they're telling. I say this all the time, but I think this is a great example of the reverse of that, where the scope, I usually say, like, if you have a narrow scope, keep it narrow. They have a massive scope to this story, but they're telling it very narrowly.
Mm-hmm.
So they're actively not considering what the outcome of this is, and they're playing it off like this great, you know, emotional victory for everybody involved. And it's just like, you really, I don't know. I not for me.
Yeah. I don't know what you accomplished here, I guess. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
The thing that's tough about it is because Discovery's storytelling is so scattershot. I'm if I were to bet on this, I would say that this does not come back, but it's hard
to doubt it.
It's hard to tell if it would come back. And like, if it does come back, I feel like there's somewhere you can go with it. But if you're right, like being so unsure of the writing, being not sure as to whether or not this storyline is going to continue or be resolved or anything like that leads you to this point where you don't understand why the actions of this episode happened this way, because you don't know whether or not this is just a one-off, and it being a one-off is extremely unsatisfying. And mm-hmm. I thought that the problem, a lot of the problem with this one felt the most of our common criticism of note cards on a board. This entire script felt like it was just like, this has to get to this point, culminating in a bizarre sequence at the end where Burnham says, "Hey Saru, you have a sister? I have a brother. I need to go to Vulcan." And you go, what the fuck is that connection? How are you also making that connection?
They've done this in the past, so who knows if it's going to come true. Based on the next week trailer, it looks like we finally get Spock.
At least, maybe in a dream sequence or something, though, because that was not very realistic looking to me. Yeah.
Also, I was going to say, if he's just been on fucking Vulcan this whole time...
He's not.
He better not be. Because the way that they presented that trailer, it looked like she's going to Vulcan and Spock is on Vulcan.
That's what leads me to think it's a memory thing.
It has to be. Yeah. If he's on fucking Vulcan, I'm done with this show. We can still do the podcast, but I'm not watching this show. If they get to Vulcan and he's on Vulcan.
What was the connection between you have a sibling, I have a sibling, therefore I must go to Vulcan? Like it's such an arbitrary decision on Burnham's part to actually get there.
And you have a father, I have a father, I should call my dad.
The other sort of weird thing about this one is this was the first episode that really showed the light to me of how useless Ash Tyler is and how bizarre it is that they have stuck him into this Section 31 role with no one questioning that whatsoever. He's just like a trusted agent of Section 31, and he's allowed to stand in the background. He's doing the actor's doing a fantastic job just standing around in the background, I must say. But
and by eating alone. He does a lot of eating alone in this show.
You know what? Like him having such an impact on this feels really, when you consider that character's arc and where he came from, what an abrupt switch they did to move him, to bring him onto the show, that they insert him into Section 31 and that he's basically a trusted agent of that. Like no one is like, hey, it's kind of weird that you basically were trying to sabotage the Federation, and then you went off to Kronos, and then you lied about this, and now you're just this agent that Pike actually tells important information to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I think that's excuse me. I think that's part of the point of that scene where he's eating by himself, is that's the least amount of character work you could possibly do to show that people don't like being around him.
Yeah, yeah.
But that aside, I was thinking last night, what is his character?
Like, doesn't have one. The closest, doesn't have one.
Yeah, the closest I could get is, I was kind of confused when they were talking about whatever. I don't know if it was during the spinning vomit scene, but his point of view seems to be that, no, I guess it was the scene with Pike, because his point of view seems to be that the one at the very end.
He represents Section 31's idea that the Red Angel is a time-traveling alien with bad intentions.
Right, and his point of view seems to be that he was involved in the previous war, and the previous war really fucked him up. So he's going to do whatever he has to do to prevent there from being another war,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know who is speaking there. Like, what is his? I don't know what his standing is as far as this Ash Voke thing.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Is that a thing anymore? Did they just forget that happened? I'm not saying that you have to get into it, but it's like I don't know. I feel like, outside of that one scene, he doesn't really do anything other than just stand in the background and, you know, be part of the techno babble.
Yes.
So I don't really know. I guess he's there to offer the counterpoint that the Red Angel thing might be a bad thing.
I don't even get that. If that's what they're trying to do, I don't get the... We had talked in the previous episode about how Section 31 and Pike are supposed to be antagonistic or racing against each other. That's not the impression I get from it. It seems like they're really working hand in hand, and I don't quite understand why. I only understand it on a casting level, that they're like, well, this guy is a cast member, so we have to include him in the show, but it doesn't make sense that he is a part of Discovery's complement. Like, he doesn't add anything by being there.
You know what's actually kind of interesting about this is, last season, when they revealed the whole thing with him being a double agent and all this kind of shit and it being very unsatisfying, one of the things that I said that I wish they had done was, I wish that they had revealed to the audience that he was a double agent, because not knowing he's a double agent doesn't build any tension, at least not the way that they did it. And if you know that he's a double agent, but the other characters don't know, then you've got this active antagonism that's happening that the main characters aren't seeing, and yeah. it's more interesting story that way. This time he is actually basically placed in that position where he is the point of contact to Section 31 that they've set up as this more intense black ops counterpoint to Discovery, and none of that is actually coming into play. Like, there's nothing, there's no scene in this where he gets information before Pike does and, like, very slyly feeds it to Section 31. You know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Right.
Like, there's nothing like that that makes having him on the ship have any sort of weight to it. It's just, you get that one scene where he's like, I was in the war, it was tough, and I was a Klingon once. And I don't want that. I don't want anybody else to become a Klingon. Not doing any interactions with him and Burnham. It wasn't really the episode for that, but there's really nothing in this episode where they do that.
I think the show has forgotten that they had a relationship. I don't think it cares anymore.
I think it's gonna come up when they need it to.
Okay.
It's not something that they're actively.
Well, here's the.
They're not watering that plant at all.
If you're going to have a black ops...
They're just
going to
buy you a new one when you need a new plant.
If you're going to have a black ops CIA-esque organization like Section 31 in this, right? Wouldn't it make more sense for Section 31 to be the ones that trigger the mass evolution? You know, if their point is that they're the ones who do things that they're willing to do to for the greater good, they're willing to sort of cut corners with things, which is kind of what Section 31 is set up as. Them doing this as a way to, in their mind, even the playing field makes more sense than the representatives of Starfleet doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like it should be that should be Ash's idea, and it should be Ash, or it shouldn't be Ash's idea. It should be an idea that comes up that Ash then makes happen.
Yes, against the wishes of everybody else. Yes. But he does he changes the paradigm for that world, and it's unclear whether or not what he's done is good or bad by the end of the episode. Yeah. But they don't do anything with that.
Especially since he's another character. He's the only other character on that ship that can identify with Saru, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because Saru's whole thing is that, you know, the Ba'ul were oppressive to his people and enslaving them or whatever and killing them. The only other person on that ship that comes close to being able to identify with that we know of is Tyler.
Yeah, sort of ties into the Vok-Klingon argument of purity in a way. Like where the Klingons and Vok would probably see the oppression of a race as like a huge downside, like in a way that humans don't. They see it more as like an honor thing, and I think that the Klingon argument would actually apply here, where in order to be racially pure, you kind of have to be free of your oppressors. And the Klingons were afraid of the Federation as oppressors in the first season, and it feels like that would be a thing that the Klingons could tie into here, but they don't do that.
Yeah, and from the Tyler end, Tyler was a prisoner of war and got tortured and turned into this monster. Mm-hmm. So you would think that he would sympathize with what Saru's going through as well. I think now that we're talking about it, Ash deserved a much bigger role in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like the idea coming from Burnham that what if we just evolve the entire species? That like that's talk about breaking the fucking Prime Directive.
they do some weird lip service with the Prime Directive at the start of this, which is that they know about warp technology, so it's not really breaking the Prime Directive. Yeah. Yeah.
Also, I actually wrote that down too because I thought it was very odd. They're talking about that and whether or not they can break General Order 1, and Pike says we can bend General Order 1, but let's try not to break it. Mm-hmm. Isn't that completely contrary to his standpoint from the last episode where they dealt with this, the church episode?
Yes, the Prime Directive is the primary thing for Pike in that episode.
The whole point of that episode was that he didn't want to break the Prime Directive. Even in that case, technically, they weren't really doing that, depending on what the point of view.
Right.
This one is they are actively doing it. And I guess the interesting kind of question that popped up that I thought was interesting, but of course they didn't ever talk about again, is if you've got a world where half of the population has like if you picture a world where the only two countries in the entire world are the United States and like the deepest parts of the jungle of like the Congo or something. And the United States develops nuclear weapons, and the Congo has no idea what nuclear weapons are. Does the alien species think it's okay to contact Earth because half of them have discovered nuclear weapons?
That's the argument that they make here. It gets a little wishy-washy, I think, and maybe that's intentional as a way for them to do this. But Saru's whole thing, like his origin story, makes it sound like they basically gave him the deal of you can join us, but you can never go back because you can't tell your people about us. And this flies in the face of that. So the episode itself is just confused about whether or not they can screw with the Kelpians. And eventually they decide, well, we kind of have to for this episode. We have to screw with the Kelpians.
Yeah. I was on board with it up until they it reminded me of that. Did you ever see Elysium?
That's the mech suit movie, right?
Yeah, with Matt Damon.
I did not see it.
Well, they've got this thing where like the Earth is populated with almost exclusively poor people now, and all the rich people moved into this floating satellite world. Mm-hmm. And there are certain I forget exactly what the MacGuffin-y thing is, but there's a certain thing that only the rich people have access to, and the poor people biologically cannot use it because it is not, the thing is built for only rich people or whatever.
Right.
Anyway. Yeah. So the big triumphant moment in Elysium is where Matt Damon breaks into like the computer room where they control the programming for these machines that only the rich people can use. And he pulls up like an MS-DOS screen and the programming says like, can only be used by rich Americans. And then he goes in and deletes rich and writes in all. Or like rich people, and he writes in all people. And that right. changes the entire function of the machine, so now everybody can use it. And that's how it felt to me, this plot twist or this plot movement at the end, where it's just like, this is a really hacky way to make this like grand epic gesture that you really are not thinking out here.
Yeah, yeah, I'd agree. I think that whole storyline is kind of a good summation of Discovery, which is while you're watching it, you're kind of like, wow, this is moving real fast. And I think what's going on is kind of cool. But then when you stop and think about it, it's just a little bit, not a little bit, it sort of totally crumbles underneath you, underneath your feet, and you're not really sure what you're standing on at any point. So I guess we can talk about the Red Angel too at the end here, which now seems to be definitely a time traveler. That's what they're pushing at us. Looks like it's a female. They do the funny thing of Saru has great eyesight and he managed to look at it. It looks, I tweeted about this, it looks a lot like Dr. Octopus from Spider-Man, now that I'm thinking about it.
It does.
And the trailer for next week's episode have Dr. Octopus tentacles from Spider-Man 2 in them.
Oh, I was thinking it looked like the things from The Matrix, the sentinels from The Matrix.
Oh, maybe that's it, yeah.
Drill
yeah.
their way into the ship, much like it drills its way into the ship in the trailer.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I guess that would work. So, what'd you think of the Red Angel? Total Deus Ex Machina ending, where this thing saves the day. Although, it's not Deus Ex Machina, because they have kind of been saying that this is what this thing is doing for the entire season. So even if it is a cheat in the episode itself, it makes sense within the context of the larger story. So it's a weird little contradiction.
Yeah, I didn't know what was going on at first, because I kind of turned my head away briefly. I think I was writing a note right after Pike had said something about firing photon torpedoes. Mm-hmm. So I turned my head away and then turned it back as this red thing was going past the ship. So I thought they fired on the thing.
Oh, gotcha.
I didn't realize until the angel showed up that it was the Red Angel. I would say, I guess this is something they had to do eventually, because they need to move that Red Angel plot forward. However, I don't like that up until this point, the Red Angel has been more or less not getting involved with the story.
It's leading them to the story is what it's done, yeah.
The closest thing that it's come is it moved that group of people from Earth onto this new planet, but that was like 300 years ago.
Yes.
And it's been leading them, but not interfering. And so I don't love the fact that it interfered.
Yes.
Unless it turns out to be Saru's sister or some shit like that, which wouldn't... I don't know what that would mean, but it wouldn't put it past them.
I mean...
It's probably going to be May.
It's got to be Burnham, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
If
it's Burnham, that's just like the most blatantly on the nose illustration of everything we've talked about with her this season, where it's just like she is the all-knowing, all-doing character. Yeah. To literally make her this god character that they've been chasing for the whole thing. I really hope that's not the case.
Yeah, I don't really like speculating about stuff like this, so I'm not going to. My opinion of it is that I was mostly just surprised by what you're saying, is that the Red Angel actively interfered with them in this case, and that doesn't seem to be the methodology of it. I was actually, you know... It makes sense in a total Star Trek-y way that they're like, this is an advanced time traveler with some kind of mech suit that it's wearing. Fine, I guess. That seems a little bit silly to me, even on a Star Trek angle. It feels a little bit odd. It feels very comic book-y, which is not totally detached from Star Trek, but it certainly felt like something that I wasn't expecting. I don't really know what I was expecting.
What would you do if they find the Red Angel, and it takes its helmet off and turns around, and it's Kira?
it would be Dax. I think Dax would make the most sense in this timeline. Yeah. I don't know. That's about it. The only other thing that I really wanted to touch on was the Ba'ul, which I think were actually the best part of the episode, because I love their design, and I like the idea of them The concept of them having turned the tables on their oppressors and they're trying to protect them, I thought was a really kind of clever idea to go with.
I thought the thing was going to turn out that they weren't actually killing the Kelpians, but that the Kelpians were the Ba'ul.
Yes, I thought they were the evolved version of the Ba'ul. Yeah, yeah. Or the evolved version of the Kelpians who turned into the Ba'ul.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad they didn't do that.
I was thinking that the entire time. That would have been the cliche sort of answer, I think. And what they do here is more interesting, I think. And if the show is interested in exploring that, I think it actually could have built up to something of an episode from that. Like, what is the appropriate response for Discovery in this case, where this group of people have been oppressed by this group and they kind of turn the tables on them? Is it fair to turn the tables back on them and give their enemy these great weapons? And as you say, to not have a sit down scene between them where we determine that they've even if it's quickly done, that they've hashed out a like truce between the two sides.
Right.
Feels really, really odd to end that way.
And they are presented as such an objectively evil force.
Yeah.
From the way that the voice sounds on the communicator to the way that they look.
They look like Armus from Skin of Evil, which is the ultimate bad guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, if that thing had looked like a Ba'ul, then killing Yar would have been much more effective, I think.
I assume they did that just to make the flip that much more impactful. You know, they're like, how evil can we make these guys?
Right.
And, yeah.
But they don't follow through with it.
No.
Because they don't. They set up these guys to be objectively evil, and then they come out with this information that they're not evil, they are just defending themselves.
Maybe too extremely, but they are trying to defend themselves.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And so when they give all this power back to the Kelpians, there's no like reconsidering of the Ba'ul. It's just like, now you have all the guns.
Or don't you feel that the Ba'ul are familiar with Starfleet? Shouldn't they explain the situation to them about what's going on?
Yeah, you would think so. Yeah, like, instead of just demanding that they give them Saru.
Right. It feels like
whatever.
Yeah.
I'm willing to let that stuff. That's fine. You got to move your story forward somehow, right?
Well, I think that ties into the whole thing of them just being unnecessarily evil for no reason. Like, the explaining that situation is a remedy to the problem, and the only reason that it's a story is because they're hiding information that I feel is natural for them to come out in a resolution like this.
Excuse me. That's a good point. I also, I didn't like that they, at the end, there's no understanding. Like, I feel like the natural order, because, excuse me, Saru's anger in the situation should be less, should not be lessened by the fact that now the Kelpians have the means to fight back. It's because that's what's driving him forward in the story, right? It's like he needs to tell his people that this is a lie. He needs to tell them that the Ba'ul have been been just taking advantage of them X, Y, and Z. But I feel like the natural progression for his character is once he learns the truth about the history of the planet, he should be like, oh shit, I'm now doing what they did to me.
Yes.
This anger that I'm projecting onto them is exactly what got us into the situation from the other side.
Right.
So there should be some sort of...
Two wrongs don't make a right, is
exactly.
Saru's learn. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. That's what it should be, but that's not how it comes across. It just comes across as, now my people are enlightened and they can handle themselves better. So I feel like they dropped the ball a bit there. Also, on a slightly unrelated point, someone I think in the Discord brought up the fact that the knowledge that they got from the floating space rock in the last episode was going to turn into this like all-knowing computer that they just get all their plot information from.
Yes.
And that has already kind of started to happen, it seems, because they do pull out all that information about the Kelpians and stuff from the floating rock.
Yes.
Which I don't understand what kind of information that you would actually be able to get from that thing. Unless it's like, does it have a propulsion system that it's actually been flying around the galaxy? If I was a living planet and you grabbed hundreds of thousands of years of knowledge from me, it would be, those stars look the same.
2,000 years later.
Uh, there goes one.
Halley's Comet every 120 years or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, like what the fuck could it possibly know?
Apparently it's been going around scanning everything relevant to the plot of these episodes that would actually need to be done. I mean,
what does going around mean?
I
try not to be too magic xylophony about this stuff, but it's like, did they mention that this thing was like something that had been actively like traveling through space?
I think so.
Oh, they did. Okay, all right. That's different then.
I don't know if they did, but my understanding of it was that in the previous episode, I got the impression that it was going around sort of cataloging everything. Like that was its point.
It still is very convenient for the plot stuff for them to be like, let's check the database that we learned from the smart rock and to figure out what the next plot move is.
Well, it feels lazy in the sense that I'm used to Star Trek. What's wrong with the crew figuring this out on their own over the course of 15 minutes?
Right.
You know, right. Why do they need the rock to tell them all this information? Can't they do some kind of, you know, technobabbly advanced thing of we've analyzed their DNA and we found that the Kelpians and the Ba'ul, you know, blah blah blah. I'd be like, that's fine, that's fine. So I don't understand why they need this mechanism of this space rock to come in and tell them all the information that they have.
Also, did you love how Saru made basically a satellite phone out of one of those fucking spinning knife droids?
that was the most video gamey moment. It's like when you kill a droid in a video game and you can pick up the little piece that you need for the key card that it's carrying for some reason. Mm-hmm. What'd you think of the Ba'ul's design in context of, I was a little bit confused about why an oily muck monster has such a clean space. Like why the way that they look doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of what their technology is. And I also wasn't sure how they developed all this technology so quickly.
Why do they need hallways?
Yeah. Why do they need hallways? They just melt into a puddle and they can move between the ship. Yeah.
I don't know what they do. Is that the only form they take? I don't know. I mean, it was a cool visual, but I don't think it was, the world wasn't really considered unless like, yeah, so what about this? What if instead of going to the all-knowing space rock for the answer, they do a scan of their... Well, I guess they didn't know about that thing until later. I was going to say they do a scan of their technology or something and realize that it's Kelpian-based or some shit like that. You know, like, because why, if these things are giant muck monster guys, why would they have hallways that are suspiciously tall that look like they would be better suited to Kelpians walking around in them than muck monsters,
right?
Or something like that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot of different ways that you could have taken it. It's really just the criticism that we've had of the show is just it throws a lot of information at you in hopes that you don't really notice too much of it, or you just sort of swallow it and continue on with your day. And if you want to, I think that's a fine way to kind of watch the show. It doesn't lead to me being very satisfied with the way things come out, because I feel like this episode was a good, the episode is really a traditional Discovery episode in that it went back to this more episodic nature with the serialized story, which I do like, but it continued the trend of it's just going to blitz through these points and not really, it doesn't do the Star Trek-y thing of talking about the points. And I guess this is a good way before we go off. I had been sent a tweet about like the legalese wrangling between CBS and Viacom and about like how they have to license their stuff to each other. And I think it's incredibly boring. I don't think I would assume that is not an uncommon situation in media creation where they have to do licensing deals like that. I don't think it has any impact on the show whatsoever. And the biggest impact, the biggest reason that those kind of stories don't matter to me is because that problem has no impact on this show telling a good story. There's no reason that this show can't tell a good story. That has there's no reason to think that the licensing deals cause any kind of creative issues on the show. If they have to go outside of existing canon by 25% and make a whole totally new show, fine. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Just to make a good show and write it well, and I'll be fine with it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, the failing of the show is not that the canon stuff doesn't line up.
Right.
And it never has been.
Yep.
Like that's frustrating on a certain level, clearly, obviously. But that has never been the problem here.
They don't have a license on Star Trek usually tells its episodes about these moral moments that the crew has to deal with. Discovery doesn't want to do that, but you could. If you wanted this show to feel like Star Trek, even if it doesn't look like it, they have to tell their stories differently. This is not a... Yeah. This is not the way that Star Trek traditionally tells its stories, and I don't want them to repeat what the 90s Trek series did, but kind of maybe examining the relationships between the Ba'ul and the Kelpians and what this means and whether it's right to interfere with them, maybe that's kind of a way to tell this story in a Star Trek-y language, but they didn't want to do it. So you end up with this thing where, yes, the aesthetic is different, but it's ultimately the soul of the show is what's different, and the soul of the show is poorly written to a point where the episodes themselves are not satisfying for me.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that they have an hour's worth of television and it feels like they don't have enough time because they move so fast and they have so many balls up in the air at once. And then they end up doing these ridiculous fixes like the make everybody evolved and stuff. Or,
yeah.
You know, he transferred his life force through a tear.
And honestly, like nothing depresses me more than when I launch the app and it says 56 minutes. And I go, oh, God, like, why is this 56 minutes long?
Yeah,
I just want it to be 44 minutes and be over.
It reminds me a bit of pro wrestling in that if you watch Monday Night Raw, Monday Night Raw is 3 hours long and it still feels like they don't have enough time to do everything because of, in their case, they spend so much time on just long-winded shit that is not very fun to watch anymore. But it's like they have all this time, but they somehow still manage to feel like they need more of it. And that's how I feel about this show, where it's like, you've got plenty of time to deal with this stuff. Like, you can tell these stories in an hour. You've had 300 some odd episodes of Star Trek between the other seasons, or, you know, all the other series.
800?
Sure. 800 episodes that are all 40 minutes long, where they manage to tell stories that are just as complex as what they're doing here, but more, maybe 60% of them are, 55 to 60% of them are more satisfying than this.
Yeah.
And is that because there's too much going on?
That's a good question. What would you think?
Focusing on too much, or moving the plot forward too quickly. I don't know. Just the last thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because especially if you look at this episode, right? There's nobody in this episode. It's not like they've got all of these characters that you've got the main characters you're dealing with. And then the crux of your story taking place on the Kelpian planet is like two people.
Yeah.
So it feels like they're going so big, but the story is still very small and unsatisfying. And it's hard to pinpoint exactly what the problem is.
Right. It's not the Game of Thrones problem where you have too little time to, you have to be very stringent on how they dole out time for their stories to move along. Like, you have to move people along. So you need to write Game of Thrones scenes that, even if you don't see this person a lot, the scene that you do see them for 3 minutes is very important to them. Mm-hmm. And Discovery doesn't have that. Discovery does not have a lot of plot threads moving at the same time. It's really just this one story that they plug the characters in as they need be. And if they're not being used, they literally stand in the background of the bridge.
I actually liked that first bridge scene where they were all kind of hashing out what to do, and then it ended with Saru and Pike kind of getting into each other's face. I liked that scene.
I like the Saru and Pike. I also liked Pike talking to the Ba'ul in this. That felt very for him.
I hate saying this because, you know, it can very easily get misconstrued as, you know, whatever, but Anson Mount is the best part of the show.
He feels the most
traditional. He's consistently good.
Yeah.
Not only is he traditional, but his presence is great. And
traditional in the sense of what you expect from a Starfleet captain, sort of. Not that he's a white straight male standing in the center of it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a scene, I think it's that scene where they have the cameras kind of going around, and then they do this sort of like low shot where he like steps towards the camera, and you're like, fuck yeah, man, that's the captain of the ship right there. Like, he feels like that character in a way that some of the other ones don't really feel. I liked that scene. I thought that was good. I hated that scene where Saru transports him down to the planet. A really good example of what we talk about as far as like manufacturing their drama.
You mean when Saru beams himself down and Burnham draws the gun on him? Yeah.
Yeah. He goes to beam himself down. He sets the beamer, the transporter, on a 60-second timer.
Very long timer.
Standing on the thing.
Very long timer for what he needs to do.
Very long. Yeah. Yes, very long timer. That was the first thing I thought. I was like, set it for 10 fucking seconds, man. How long is it going to take you to get up there? But he's up there. Burnham shows up and pulls a gun on him. And at no point walks over to the transporter and shuts the transporter off.
shoots the transporter.
Yeah, like, so you're going to pull a gun on him because, as we all know, what's more dramatic than a gun, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
As Michael Scott says, accurately. So your scene now becomes whether or not Burnham's going to fucking shoot him because he's transporting down to the planet as opposed to, and don't, if Saru knows how to work the transporter, Burnham knows how to work the transporter. So don't tell me that she can't just walk over there and hit control all force quit on the transporter program.
Also threatened to shoot him after they've kind of decided that it's okay to interfere with this planet. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's honestly, that's another sequence where I feel like if you had switched Burnham and Tyler.
Yes, right? Makes more sense.
And so, yeah, Saru goes down, Tyler comes in, you think Tyler's going to do something or whatever, and then he's like, I'm not going to stop you, go ahead and do it, I want you to do it. Like, I'm on your side. And then he goes, that's more interesting.
Yep.
That's an actual character moment instead of this hackneyed shit where Burnham's not going to fucking shoot him.
Right.
You know, it's like, that's the thing I hated about the early days of The Walking Dead was that everybody was always pulling guns on everybody. You know, no one was getting shot. Now I guess they kill everybody. But in the first, like, season of that show, every episode had a scene where every character pulls a gun on the other character when they get into an argument. No one's ever going to get shot in those scenarios. When has that ever happened?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's tension that you don't earn. That they are built there, they're thrusting on you with this artificial thing of, oh, maybe Burnham's going to shoot him. And plus, it's a stun gun. Shoot him then.
Right.
Like, I understand the point of the scene is that by not stopping him, she is capitulating with his point of view. But, like, I don't know. Pulling a gun on him is stupid.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to stop him... Yeah, if you're going to stop him, you can stop him without shooting him. You don't have to shoot the guy. I don't know. It's stuff like that that it's, like you said, it's, if you step back, I can say, yeah, this is an episode of Discovery. It was fine. This is what I've come to expect from the show, for better or worse. It is what it is. This was better than the last one.
Yes. Yep.
But, you know, I wish it was more considered,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, I wish it was. I think my final thing with you wondering like where the problem would be, it really seems to be that the show seems to not recognize the question that's at the center of each episode. And because it doesn't recognize the question, it instead relies on scenes around that are built more for action scenes where they're trying to create this sense of high tension where the tension should come from the narrative. They're not content to do that. They don't really want to talk about whether or not this slavery thing is a problem. They just want to do the thing of Saru pushing the button and causing the light to turn red and everyone gets shot and everyone convulses. And that seems to be where the focus is. And I think that that's unfortunate, but we're going to take a break.
Well,
go ahead.
Before we do that, I did want to talk about the other thing we haven't talked about because it's actually a plot thread that they've started that I am into so far that I don't know if they're going to continue with and maintain. I actually really liked that one scene with Culver in sick bay.
I don't know what they're doing with him, so I'll be interested to see what happens.
I don't know either, but I liked the concept of this, like, it's him, but it's not him.
Right.
Like, the body is, it's this perfect new body, and I constantly think about this stuff when it comes to like AI and this idea of like, oh, it's going to be in the future, you'll be able to upload your consciousness into a robot and live forever. It's like, well, yeah, but it's not you. Right. If I scan a piece of my artwork into the computer and then I tear the artwork up, the artwork has been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
That work.
I don't know that one.
It exists, but it's different.
I know. Sorry, I was talking about AI and my Alexa just started talking at me. I'm sorry. I'll stop saying disparaging things about AI. But you know, if I take that piece of art that all that work went into to create and I tear it up, it has been destroyed.
Yes.
There is no, just because I have a copy of it and that copy exists does not mean, like, in the human terms, your consciousness is still destroyed. Unless it's not the same thing.
Right.
And so I like this idea that it seems like they're going with him where he's a copy of Culver, but it's not exactly the same thing. And he's wrestling with that idea of this, of being this new thing or whatever. I don't know if that's where they're going to go with, but it's kind of a nice germ. However, that being said, I really hope this plot line involves Culver smacking that fucking look off of Stamets's face. That, like, bemused Muppet face that he does, where it's like any scene with Culver, his eyebrows go through the top of his head.
Yeah.
Then he does this like Muppet grin where it's just like, fucking, that's the only way he can emote being in love with this guy. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think Stamets, Anthony Rapp, is a particularly great actor. Couple things. I'll try to sync it. I think it's Culber, not Culver.
God damn it. Again?
Just so that people don't yell. And then I would agree with you. I mean, what's most interesting about...
I have a cold, so it causes me to say my V's as B's.
I have a Culver. It's a... The reason I'm interested in is mostly because of the mystery of it at this point.
Yeah.
And I don't have a lot of high hopes for whatever they're trying to reveal. I think that what you're saying is fine. I don't really know how that ties in thematically to what the season has been doing so far.
Sure.
And
sure.
And
dude is jacked too, by the way.
He is jacked. Holy crap. I mean, that was funny about when the doctor's like, your body is now the physically perfect version of you. It's like, Well, he looks great, but he does have a lot of gray hair.
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah.
I don't know.
His scars are gone, but he still has gray hair. Very good point.
I don't know how perfect it would be, but yeah, that'll be interesting. I think it also suffers from Discovery's pacing problem, which is that they're like, okay, we don't have a lot of time. The minute you sit up from your sickbay bed, look extremely concerned for the rest of your screen time. Just look concerned. Like, nothing is right in your universe, yes. And they will sell it. Yeah. I think that's it. We're going to take a break, play an audio clip. Hank, Clay are going to come back, give our final thoughts, and then we'll call it a day.
What's this? Commander Saru's report. Shared in the spirit of cooperation. Thanks to Commander Saru's enhanced eyesight, he was able to get a better look at the Red Angel.
The entity appears to be a humanoid, wearing a mechanized suit, exhibiting technology far beyond present Federation capabilities.
So, it's someone, and whether human or alien, it has extremely advanced technology.
Someone who is manipulating the fates of entire species. Control? Which model Section 31's threat assessments is probably rightfully alarmed by... What is it? A time-traveling being pursuing its own agenda?
All right, everybody. So we're done with The Sounds of Thunder, which is an interesting title for this episode. I don't really know if it's my favorite of the season. I doubt it, but it is what it is. Clay, we're done with this one. Looking forward to next week. There seems to be at least be Spock on screen. We'll see how that goes.
Spock no, on Spock.
No Spore. Action. No Spore Network in this one, which I was pleased about. Yeah. Well, except for the Culber thing, if you consider that to be Spore Network related. This is not the worst episode of the season. I didn't think. I was actually interested in that. I thought last week's was much worse, but It seems to be a little bit of a unpopular opinion to think that this one is better. People seem to think that this one's a little bit worse, at least online was the quick reaction to it. That was interesting to me just because I thought that if you consider Discovery's goal to be sort of like brainless, fast-paced action, I think that this show is more successful at it than a lot of their previous ones. But it's maybe not what you're looking for, but I think that in terms of what Discovery is, I think this actually gets kind of close to being a decent idea of what a Discovery episode could be, even if it's not really what you'd expect from a Star Trek series.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it has a lot of ups. I don't think it ever gets as engaging action-wise as the last episode did with the Spore Drive, like, crushing the ship and all that kind of stuff. I thought that stuff was great.
Even with the ships of the Ba'ul flying out and sort of surrounding the Discovery?
That was fine. Yeah. I mean, whatever. It didn't amount to anything.
No, it doesn't.
They just flew back. I thought this one felt like Star Trek to me. Or at least it felt close to Star Trek. I'm not saying it's perfect or anything, obviously, but it was, there were times where I was watching it thinking like, yeah, this feels like what I want from a Star Trek show. At least like, if not exactly what was happening, like I'm watching Pike on the bridge engaging with his crew, dealing with this thing, talking through the communicator. I'm like, all right, this
Saru's journey feels very Star Trek-y too.
Yeah. Whether or not they stick the landing, I clearly don't think they did.
The ending is not like Star Trek-y.
I would feel like this is like if you're watching one of those dirt bike trick things, the guy takes the bike off the ramp, starts his like 450, and then about halfway through just lets go of the handlebars and flies off into another direction. But the attempt was appreciated.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was all right. It didn't make me hate it. It was all right.
Yeah. Just all right. We'll see where they go from here, I think.
Telling you, Spock is on Vulcan. I'm done.
Done with it. Yeah, I'm looking forward to,
if it turns out that his mom found him like 3 episodes ago and brought him back to Vulcan.
That's true. Would make sense, wouldn't it? Done. If she's been hiding him in the basement or something like that. Yeah, that would actually
also
make sense.
I would like to talk about one thing very briefly. I do think that we talked about this a little bit last week, where the where is the ship problem is becoming less of a problem because they're actively going towards something. But as of this episode, what are they going towards now? So
they're still chasing Spock, right? Is that
are
not,
they?
Is that not happening?
Well, apparently they're going to Vulcan next week.
Oh, that's true.
So are they just like, it's not a huge deal where in space they are, but they've been actively moving forward trying to track down Spock. And they in this one, okay, fine. They were following the red beacon or whatever that brought them to the Kelpian homeworld just completely by accident.
Yes.
Because it's not a world that anyone really knows where it is, I guess. So they kind of just stumbled across it. But from this point, what are they following? Are they just abandoning their quest because Burnham wants to go to Vulcan? Or is it going to be like Burnham just is landing on Vulcan in a shuttlecraft?
Right.
And they never explain whether or not they've given up their search or anything. And it's... Maybe now
show doesn't have a tremendous amount of importance on distance.
Yeah, they don't care.
It doesn't care about spatial distance in this. No. Like anyone is just right next door to wherever they need to be. Yeah.
And I was wondering, someone who is more fluent in the older shows, particularly I would say TNG or maybe like Voyager or something. Not so much Deep Space Nine because everyone usually comes to them on that show. Could tell me whether or not this is more common in the old show than I think it is. Because the Enterprise always seems to have people coming to it, and they're just in the – who knows where the Enterprise is? They always kind of – the captain's log always establishes where they are for the most part.
Yes.
But is there the same frequency of people just showing up at the Enterprise or the Enterprise just showing up at places unmotivated as is in this show?
I would assume not. It always seems like the older series always make it sound like it was a planned encounter with people. And if it's not, it's sort of the reveal that they're there is kind of treated as a revelation. It's like, oh my God, like, what are you doing here? So I would assume not, but I can't say with any kind of certainty.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I don't know. I didn't know if it was something that I was being unreasonably hard on.
Well, it's one of those things that wouldn't matter if the rationale for going there was better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I don't have a problem with her going to Vulcan if there was actually a reason to go to Vulcan. There doesn't seem to be any reason to go to Vulcan at this point. So it feels very detached from their current mission.
Yeah. I mean, all it would really take is like getting another energy signature or some shit like that, where it's like, where is that going? Well, it seems like it's going to Vulcan. And then her being like, well, I guess I'm going home or some shit like that.
Yeah. Burnham has a vision from the Red Angel and sees Vulcan for some reason, and it's like, I guess I have to go back there to see what's going on. I don't know.
Or is like, you know, that motorcycle outfit that the Red Angel is wearing looks like one from the shop next to my house on Vulcan.
We'll see. This Red Angel thing is going to be interesting when they reveal. I don't like the speculation as to what it is, or I don't personally like to, just because I think I'm always going to be wrong, and I don't really anticipate what they're going to do with it. But
there's honestly nothing more frustrating than spending a lot of time speculating about something and then being completely wrong about
it. Right, yeah. The episode 10 of this season is called The Red Angel. So I think that's when we are going to get some information about that. So we have a little bit of a ways to go.
I'll be honest with you. If it just goes completely sideways and it turns into this weird time travel shit, I'm down. Whatever.
Just go crazy with it.
Yeah, I think I think it would be more satisfying this season for that kind of change than it was in the previous season, where they're just like, we're going to fuck off to the mirror universe for 3 episodes in the middle of a fucking galactic war.
Right.
We're going to come back in a year later and the Klingons fucking won the war.
Yeah.
I think it would be that if you imagine this season up to this point as being the first hour or first hour and a half of 2001 A Space Odyssey, I would welcome the last half hour of 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think we're done. I think we're done with this one. It's The Sounds of Thunder. Thank you very much for listening, guys. You can check out all the social media links, Facebook, Twitter, Discord.
And the thunder.
You can support the show at Patreon. There's a PayPal link, and there's also the merchandise Teespring store. And lastly, if you mention the show on Reddit or things like that, it's much appreciated if you're enjoying it. Spread the word.
I hope when they meet the Red Angel, they get in their face and they go, who do you think you are? Flying around being a red star.
Check out our Radio Star Murders podcast, which we just started, which we're looking at music videos. And the reason Clay's been singing Thunder.
Yeah, those jokes will make a lot more sense if you listen to that.
The reason we've been talking about Thunder is that was our first episode. We did Imagine Dragons Thunder. So you can check that out if you're interested in music video stuff.
An appropriate number of people have responded with, why did you do that song?
Yes.
And I appreciated your answer, which was, well, you got to do something.
Someone was like, hey, I've never heard of this song, never heard of the video, never heard of the band. What a bizarre choice. And I just want to say to that kind of mindset, think about all the songs in the world. Think about how many that statement apply to. And then maybe think about twice about saying something like that. It's just like, yes, sometimes you're not going. And actually, since it's such a huge fucking hit, I think more about your inability to not know the song than anything, quite frankly. Yeah,
that's what they call a clap back, I think.
It's just such a bizarre statement. It's like, there's a billion goddamn songs in the world. What do you mean? Of course there are going to be some that you've never heard of.
Next week we should do some obscure classical piece. A Shostakovich movie or something.
That's it. We're done with Sounds of Thunder. We'll be back next week with whatever that Discovery episode is. And in the meantime, DS9 continues unabated. Clay, do you have anything you want to say before we go?
No. The Badass Podcast, Batman the Animated Series Show podcast. Me and Sean Murphy talk about Batman the Animated Series is up the entire first season. If you're into that kind of thing, and we are currently working on season 2. We're aiming for, the next volume of Batman White Knight comes out this summer, I think. So I think we might, if we can get enough of them done, I think I'm going to start putting them out as sort of a lead up to that. Because Sean talks about the next volume in a non-spoilery fashion. So I think it'll be a nice little insight into his work, into his process and stuff as that book starts to come out.
Sure. Makes sense. We'll let you know when the date approaches for those releases of those episodes. I think that's it. Guys, thank you very much for listening. Check out the Radio Star Murders podcast. You can check out Real Ripe and Real Rotten. We just did A Star Is Born for that, so you can check out all the other stuff that is going on the channel. We'll be back with DS9 on Tuesday, and then the next Discovery is on Friday, so we'll see you then.